So, Darren, do you want to tell us a little bit about the radio program that you you and Nancy both do on Saturday mornings?
Sure, absolutely. I can. You're very faint.
Okay.
So if you can possibly boost the audio a little bit on my end, I appreciate it.
Okay.
Same here.
Okay.
But, we host Govern America every Saturday morning from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. Eastern Time. That would be, 6, very early in the morning there, where you are.
Yes.
You're in, I think you're...
We're in Colorado.
Yeah, okay. So it's pretty early in the morning there. Of course, the archives are available there at Republic Broadcasting. What we do is we gather together information along the week. We focus primarily on the topics of Agenda 21, sustainable development, private property rights, which are being gutted at a massive rate today. Years ago, Melody, Rexford Tugwell, Assistant Secretary of Agriculture, an advisor to the President, said that government one day would be all controlled by, all land would be controlled by the government. And with all of these UN plans and efforts, they're all being put into place right before our eyes. And our concern is that the American people are being distracted and they're not paying attention, and we're literally having the land and our ability to live on it, own it, work it, ripped out right from underneath us. And if you don't have private property, you don't have anything. You don't have the ability to grow. You don't have the ability to live. You literally are going to be wandering from place to place. There was somebody just sent me a message from just earlier today in the form of an email, and he said he was down in Kentucky taking pictures of some of these tent cities down there, and he says the government isn't doing anything to help these people. These tent cities are going up everywhere because of the bad economy. And he says it's just really depressing. You know, we know that whenever these things erect, they're erected on public land, and the government comes in and runs the people off the land, they have no place to go. They wander from place to place, and then they come back and repitch the tents, try to rebuild whatever they can do. And this is the America that's been created for us. You know, but without land, you have no place.
And you are a refugee.
We are literally in that situation today, where we are literally the poor in the midst of a land full of plenty. And this is what globalization has done to this country. It has gutted us, despite the fact that the UN is always talking about prosperity. Chapter 3 of Agenda 21 deals with combating poverty. Yet more and more, every time we see all of these things being put into place, all of these programs, what do we have but more poverty? You know, and so that's what I hammer a lot on the show, is all you have to do is look at the results of having over a half a century of the United Nations programs at work in America, and look what we've got for our money, and look what we've got for all of their promises that they've given us. So those are the kinds of things we talk about on the show. We talk about, you know, we run the gamut. We discuss the manipulation of our food, the repeated hammering of our farmers and ranchers. I have a real passion for the food producers in this country who've been under relentless attack for probably a half a century or close to it. You know, so I don't know, Nancy. You got any thoughts to add to that?
Well, and the other thing that I would say too is, if I had to sum up our radio show, I would say that we try to demonstrate how the UN's Agenda 21 blueprint it has transpired in this nation, but also how Darren and I talk a lot about the Hegelian dialectic.
Yes.
In other words, how did they do it? How did they do it so that the American people basically continue to support them doing this horrible thing to the people of this country? And it is actually a system of logic. It's an old system. It is taught in the Ivy League schools, and it is certainly taught to the legal minds and the think tanks of this nation, and the it is how we have bought this bill of goods and continue to vote for the people who are selling this bill of goods to the people of this nation, and the destruction that it has caused to the people.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I mean, I've often said that the Hegelian dialectic is really the means by which all change happens today, because all you have to do is look at the headlines. We have a ton of them on the website. We track these things, on a regular basis, and you see a pattern in the news every single day: crisis, 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 crisis.
Right.
And it's all it's all manufactured for us for a specific reason, and that's because crises equals opportunity. Whenever you have a problem, you have people clamoring for change. You have the conditioning of the public mind wanting the changes because they think they're necessary. And that's the Hegelian dialectic, because basically a dialectic is an argument. You know, and we have dialectical arguments on one side in the form of problems, and then we have proposed solutions to those problems, which is the opposition to the original thesis or problem, and those, that's the antithesis. And the two finally come together and move society toward a predetermined outcome, which is their synthetical societal solution that they've created, which is exactly what they wanted to do in the first place.
Yeah.
It's often referred to as problem-reaction-solution.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. A lot of people, you know, and that's easier for a lot of people to understand, but the point is that this is why we have the bird flu. This is why we have the swine flu. This is why we've had September 11th. I mean, look how far toward the communistic system that we've come since September 11th, and this contrived terrorism thing, which we know, you know, there's so much that could be said about 9/11 and how that was an orchestrated situation by the administration and those shadow handlers that are operating in the shadows that control them. I mean, we know Bush and Obama, Osama bin Laden, the bin Laden family, they're business partners to this day, to a joint venture called the Carlyle Group. We know that, Bush's brother controlled security for Dulles, the United Airlines, and the World Trade Center. We know that there were a lot of put options put on the airlines prior to September 11th, prior to that date. Those have, to my knowledge, have never been investigated, never been followed through on. We know back in the late 90s, John Maresca of Unocal testified before Congress about the need to build a pipeline through the Caspian Sea region, through Afghanistan, you know, to get the oil out of the Caspian Sea region. So, I mean, there's just a ton of evidence out there to prove that 9/11 was an orchestrated situation. And that's just one of many. But I use that as an example to explain just how effective the Hegelian dialectic is, because very few people, right after that thing, now it's come out pretty much in the mainstream now, a lot of people have understood that to be a fraudulent situation. But, I mean, it's been very effective because they have moved us further and further. I mean, who would have thought 10 years ago, Melody, that we would be talking about, we would be having debates about how, whether or not waterboarding is torture or not. I mean, this is how far we've come in this country toward absolute, unbelievable totalitarian control. I mean, iron-fisted government.
Right. That Hegelian dialectic can be done as, like you're talking about, false flag events, and there's governments seem to like to use false flag events, and when people started looking into the 9/11 event, they started finding out that many of our wars had been perpetrated by these false flag events. But then a Hegelian dialectic can be used in letting potholes develop in your street and getting the people to start demanding something. And and then your city or county bringing up some sort of an agenda change.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, Melody, when you talk about the catalyst of crisis or the dialectic, there's nowhere that you can look that you can't see it. We have a crisis in education. We have a crisis in healthcare. We have a crisis in water delivery. We have a crisis in our transportation system. We have a crisis in our racial relations. We have a crisis at the southern border. We have crisis in weather. We have crisis in non-stop burning forests. It's on and on and on. Every single thing. We have a religious crisis in the United States now. Did we ever have one of those before? And you know, it's they are telling us that every single aspect of the American way of life is in crisis.
Yep.
Now, what are the odds? What are the odds for that to happen for all of you people who are say that you're 40 or you're 50 years or older, and you look at the condition of the country prior to those years? There were none of these crises existed. We had a great country.
Well, you know, it comes back to the you know, I use as an example too the I-35 bridge collapse.
Oh yes,
that was such a major thing. You know, you never heard anything about an infrastructure crisis in this country until one bridge collapsed. What was it, Minnesota?
Yeah, St. Paul.
Yeah, okay. And it was the I-35 bridge collapse, and I just happened to notice that just happened to be the NAFTA superhighway system that they wanted to build up through from Mexico up through the United States and into Canada, and they had to widen that thing anyway, you know. But all of a sudden, you know, one bridge collapsed, it went straight down, and all of a sudden, every news anchor on TV was talking about how every bridge in the country was about to fall apart. You know, that's the Hegelian dialectic, and you know,
it's meant to create fear.
Knowing about
in us.
Infrastructure privatization, the fact that they want to sell off our critical infrastructure, how all these locals, all these states are bankrupted, and these local communities are bankrupted, and suddenly you have a situation where, hey, we have all these this infrastructure, these roads, these bridges, they all need to be repaired, nobody has any money, why don't we just sell them off to some foreign country?
And that they're doing.
That's exactly what they're doing. But it's the Hegelian dialectic that makes it possible. And beating the drum about crises.
Yes.
And it gets the job done.
Can I ask you guys early on here, instead of waiting until an hour goes by like we sometimes do, to go ahead and give your websites? And also, I'd like to just ask you, as part of that, to describe what on there, for people who are just tuning in, is more of the solutions orientation, because you guys obviously believe in literacy and being informed as part of the solution, because your sites are just rich with information. But can you address the idea of these are the problems that you're seeing and some of the false solutions that you've said, so what are the real solutions you're seeing?
Mm-hmm. Sure, absolutely. Well, the website is governamerica.com. That's www.governamerica.com. And the reason why we have the name is it, basically what we do and what we talk about a lot is the need to stand up and govern and for citizens, ordinary Americans, to take their rightful role and be the governors of this country. You know, because we've seen what the outcome is of leaving government to the professionals. I mean, this is why we have the mess that we're in. You know, but when we have local people or ordinary people, and basically, our focus has been primarily on the state and local level, because the federal government, I mean, we've tried to call them, we've tried to talk to them. I mean, the federal government, largely, they're rude to you on the phone. When you call Congress, they don't care what you have to say. And it's the same for these regulatory agencies, these bureaucrats. You know, we promote that. I mean, we encourage people to do that, but at the same time, largely, the federal government is a beast. It's a behemoth. It's out of control. And so the biggest bang we have for our buck, as I see it, and I think Nancy would concur with this, is at the state and local level. I mean, we've heard from legislators that if one legislative office gets up just as few as five phone calls, I mean, they consider, on one particular topic, they consider themselves inundated. I mean, that's a lot of power. And if we can get people active in the states and active in their local communities, and this is really where the big battleground is that nobody, hardly anybody, focuses on, is in these local areas, because this is where the UN mandates are being put into place.
Sustainable development.
Absolutely.
Yes. Well, it's land confiscation.
Right, but they're utilizing...
On the local level, yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they're utilizing those terms, because a lot of people that I present the Agenda 21 terminology don't even recognize what it is.
Right. You know, and what are we, like 17 years into implementation now?
Boy, I didn't even really total up the years, but you're right.
It's insane how, you know, how fast time goes, and how few people have ever even heard of the Rio conference, of Morris Strong, of any of this stuff, you know. But Agenda 21, that 40-chapter document, is really what is shaping. It's what's shaping everything. I mean, it literally is the blueprint to micromanage all life on planet Earth.
Well, you know, one of the things that I'm running into is there is a considerable amount of our population that do not own property, so they don't even know the benefit of it. And so when we start talking about being private property being the one factor that this country was kind of predicated upon, it's kind of hard to try to talk to them. I mean, I know there's a ton of other issues that are tied into this, but what do you guys, do you run across this at all?
Nancy?
What I always tell people is, think of the pictures that you have seen on television of the displaced peoples, the refugees, who walk across borders, in and out of countries. They're starving to death. What is it? Why? Well, it's because someone else owns the land that they're standing upon and tells them to get off of it. And if you consider what is going on in this, the Agenda 21 states that no one, except for government, is to own private property. Now, when you think of the 300-plus million people in this country, no one has private property. Well, where are we supposed to be if no one can own anything, any property in this country? And who tells us where we're going? Now, that's step two for Agenda 21. Agenda 21 tells us that human populations are to be relocated. And this is very important, because this is where the topic of regionalism comes into play.
Great. And Nancy, while I'm thinking about it, can you just back off just a little bit, because yours is really, your phone seems to be a little hot on our end. So,
Melody, honey, I can't hear you.
Okay. I was going to say, if you could just back off on your end a little bit on the mic, because it seems to be a little bit hot on our end.
Oh, I'm okay. I'm loud. Okay. Well, basically, the issue of land ownership is critical to the American way of life, and it is critical to free people. If you do not have access to the ownership of land, and government only owns land, that means that you are told where you're going to be. And if that's the case, if you're told where you're going to be, that you're also going to be told what you're going to do. If you have no land, you have no access to water. You have no access to planting. You have no access to home building on your land. You can't go build something on someone else's land. You can't take water or plant gardens on someone else's land. And so what you're looking at is a badge of basically slavery.
Mm-hmm. You know, I want to build on that, too, because Chapter 7 of Agenda 21 deals with sustainable human settlement development. And, just as Nancy was just saying, human populations are to be relocated. We know that these rural areas are being more and more put off limits to human use. I mean, they've just passed a wilderness bill. I guess they have another one that I was just stumbled across some information that I still have got to go through. But I guess there's another wilderness expansion that's in the works. But,
24 million acres, Darren.
Yeah. So, yeah. You know, and one thing that I've always say to the listeners is that they're not making any more land, you know. The more land that's locked up in conservation easements, World Heritage Sites, biosphere reserves, national parks, I mean, the excuses are just incredible. How much land and how, you know, and then you got the Nature Conservancy, buying up more and more property, eating up more land, putting conservation easements on it, which are development restrictions so that you can't use the land, and either reselling it or it ends up in the hands of the government. But the point is that there's less and less and less land for the people to use, to live on, to build, and, you know, it gets to a point where, you know, and there's no place to go but in their designated population areas. Ultimately, when they get done, there's going to be no place. And the United Nations has talked a lot about how, by certain, you know, and they keep changing the figures, but they project that by certain years, burgeoning city populations are going to explode and are exploding. Well, they have no place to go because they're relocated from rural areas into the major cities. And we're seeing at the same time, and even in my area, and I know in Lansing and East Lansing and other towns that I go to, you know, we're having all of the housing is being built in a certain way where everything you need is within approximately five mile radius. So it's all being built in such a way that you don't need automobiles, you don't need any other transportation other than foot or bicycle. And there's different kinds of sustainable designs, and one of these, the ways they lay out these housing areas, one of them is called New Urbanism. But and I encourage your listeners to go through and to, I think we talked about New Urbanism the last time I was on, but your listeners can go and Google, put that into a search engine. Wikipedia, last I knew, had a good page on that where they had 13 different principles that basically define what a new urbanist neighborhood would be like. But basically, this is the housing of the future, where everybody's going to be crammed on top of each other. The businesses will be there. Your employment will be there. All in your entertainment, they'll have the theaters or whatever entertainment you're going to have. It'll all be in one little area, and that's where you're going to live. And you won't have access. I mean, they might do eco tours where they'll have very, very tightly controlled and regulated systems where you can go and experience nature. But the point is, you're not going to be able to live there. And all of this is being done, by the way, for the children. You know, they talk about, oh, we're going to do this for future generations because we have to protect all this stuff so that future generations will be able to live in a sustainable manner.
Well, and another way that you can see this now is look at the sheer number of the homeowner association communities where you go in, you buy a building, a house in one of these communities, but you don't own the land that it sits upon. And with the buying into one of these homeowner associations, you also walk out with a 100-page rule book on what you can and cannot do. Reason being, you don't own the land. Another way to see this is with what they call live-work units, where you actually live where you work. And then you're being a good green bean because then you don't have to use an automobile, which they don't want you to do.
You know what I'm...
Isn't it interesting, Melody, that we have the automobile manufacturers now being
dying.
Bankrupted? You know? I mean, doesn't that just fit right into the plan?
You know, one of the things that I've... What this is telling me is what they're using is neurolingual programming because they're reframing terminology that maybe 30, 40 years ago was the very reason they gave for getting out of the city. And so with these reframing process and of saying, oh, well, you know, we're getting into these smart growth cities where before we're getting out into the suburbia so that we didn't have the crowding, that we didn't have these, you know, these problems. And now they're turning around and turning it on its ear.
Well, I think it's kind of interesting that they talk about sprawl as being a bad thing. You know, I don't think I agree with the notion that man can't live in harmony with nature in the rural areas. You know, I mean, a lot of the crackpot garbage that the United Nations and et al. Have come up with, you know, has just not washed. You know, I mean, case in point, the spotted owl. You know, I mean, how much did we hear about the spotted owl, you know, and how, well, you know, the spotted owl can't live with human beings. It can't live alongside the humans because humans make too much noise. You know, and so they persecuted the loggers. They made a mess of our forests, you know, and now they're all up, going up in flames, all to save the spotted owl. And yet it turns out that it wasn't even human beings, human activity that was interfering with it. It turned out to be another owl. You know, it was the bar owl, and which was a lot more aggressive and everything. But, you know, I mean, they suddenly discovered that the spotted owl was surviving quite nicely in a Kmart sign in Nevada, you know, surrounded by human activity. So a lot of this stuff that the United Nations and all their little tentacles that they have all over the place, they come out with it. It's not based upon sound science. I mean, we can get into climate change and global warming, you know, as another example of that. You know, it's all a load of garbage. They have no credibility whatsoever. But when you consider that it's all based upon their predetermined agenda and what they want to cram down the throat of the American people and really the people all over the world, you know, it all makes perfect sense. But unfortunately, the controlled media reports anything the United Nations says like God himself had said it. And so, I mean, you know, this is the problem that we face. That's why programs like yours are vitally important.
Well, and this is also why every single burg, every single county, every single town, every single state now has what they call land use policies. It's all about taking private property away from us.
But it's sold as something else for another reason. And they're using loans and grants as a means to entice these communities into this.
Oh, that's the web. That's the web. That is for certain. Once you get tied in, once you declare yourself a nonprofit or you start taking government grants, the next thing that's going to happen is you're going to partner with somebody in your local community. And then your web of control broadens. And the way that it broadens really is through technology and through the computer systems and the collecting of information on people. The things that are collected about people now are absolutely just complete and total. Anywhere you go. You go to a doctor's office, you go to a school, you go to any single human service agency, you go get your plates for your car, anything that you do, you've got these computer systems. And they're all in all of these places, the hospitals, the schools, the government agencies and the nonprofits, now they're all partnered together. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, one of the things that they're incrementally destroying the infrastructure of the country, being anywhere from the ranchers and the farmers to the industrial avenues, and now they're the one that's coming up next, which is really going to surprise a few, is going to be the healthcare system. We have that healthcare system is going to be run where you go to a Walmart or something of that sort and you get your computer printout and your prescription. And that's in the data collection system was funded in this last congressional budget cycle.
That's very interesting. You know, and once again, we come back to the Hegelian dialectic, you know, because we haven't had a situation where our healthcare system, you know, once upon a time when doctors, you know, were needed, they came to your house, they made very, very good service calls, you knew who your doctor was, you knew him personally, and he dealt with the problem, he fixed the problem to the best of his abilities, and his fixing was based upon real solutions. They were based upon trying to get the person well. Now we have a situation where our health care has been connected with our employment, and consequently insurance companies have sprung up and are very involved in the process. And this was done because, well, under the guise that, well, maybe somebody might not be able to afford health care. Well, now look where we're at. We can't afford it now. And a lot of people can't get it. And it's, and as the unemployment numbers go up, and I cover these all the time on the show, thousands every week, added to the unemployment, lines, and these are all people that don't have health care. Which is a perfect crisis for the government to come in and step in again and say, hey, you know, let's take over health care. Let's control that area.
And the other interesting fact is that 50 years ago, we had an amazingly healthy population, far healthier than anyone on the entire planet. But as soon as the health care system started going into partnerships, big, big partnerships with the pharmaceutical industry, and then the pharmaceutical industry started going into partnerships with the schools and with the nonprofits and da-da-da-da-da-da on down the line and all the hospitals, suddenly we have a ridiculously and absurdly sick population with epidemic cancers, epidemic diabetes, epidemic hypertension, on and on, you know, not to mention the autism, not to mention Alzheimer's epidemic. You know, it's clearly, there is a sickness crisis that has been manufactured as well.
Well, you know, and keep in mind, you know, it's very profitable. You know, with the pharmaceutical companies, it's everything that we have seen, everything that we see going on right now is based upon depopulation, population reduction. You know, I was just telling Nancy just before we came on the air, because a lot of these, you know, the UN doesn't come right out and say that they want to reduce the world population. They talk a lot about how devastating people are to the environment, how devastating, how much water that we're using, how much land that we use, how we overuse the so-called natural resources of this Earth's fragile ecosystem. You know, so it's all of these anti-human innuendo. But when you really get in these circles and you talk to these people, you know, the bottom line is they come right out and they'll tell you that, well, you know, the biggest problem is we have too many people here. You know, and now over in England, they have been, they've had a lot of officials that have come right out and in the press, and they're starting to announce this, that we have to do something about the population numbers. And it's kind of interesting that here, I was just telling Nancy before we came on the air today, the Times Online out of the UK just came out with a story about a billionaire club that are in the bid to curb overpopulation. America's richest people meet to discuss ways of tackling a disastrous environmental and social industrial threat. If I could, I'd like to share just a little bit of this with your listeners.
Go ahead.
They say some of America's leading billionaires have met secretly to consider how their wealth could be used to slow the growth of the world's population, speed up improvements in health and education. The philanthropists who attended a summit convened on the initiative of Bill Gates, the Microsoft co-founder, discussed joining forces to overcome political and religious obstacles to change. Now, what kind of change do you think they're talking about? Described as the good club by one insider, it included David Rockefeller Jr., the patriarch of America's wealthiest dynasty, Warren Buffett, George Soros, the financiers, Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, and the media moguls Ted Turner and Oprah Winfrey. So these rich folks, and then they met at the home of Sir Paul Nurse, a British Nobel Prize biochemist and president of the Rockefeller University in Manhattan on May 5th. So this is something that we wouldn't really have any idea was going on had it not been for the foreign press reporting this. But these rich folks are getting together, and they want to solve the biggest problem that they see, and that's us.
Well, yeah, but, you know, this thing about overpopulation isn't a new thing. I mean, they've been talking about that since history began, actually, and it's been used against the populations in numerous factors, because
unfortunately, the elite seem to think that we are their, they kind of treat us like possessions and cattle. And
exactly.
So when you talk about the Rockefeller family and that sort, then this ties into where this Agenda 21 and the whole culmination of what's taking place today was really started a century or two ago, and it's being used as the means of how they're going to bring in their global governance policies.
Yes, absolutely. I can't argue with anything that you said there. I think it's important for people to understand where all this comes from. I mean, basically what we have here is the smallest, small percentage of the world's richest people basically trying to control what everyone here on the planet does, how we live, and the biggest thing is, you know, people think that it doesn't matter. People think that leaving government to the professionals is the thing to do, and to be involved in your own entertainments and everything else. But the point is, these people have us fingered for reducing our numbers in a massive way. I mean, they want to reduce the population down to levels that they consider sustainable, which means that at least two-thirds of us are not going to be here. Well, I don't know about you and your listeners, but I have a real problem with that. And the fact of the matter remains, they have a lot of power, they have a lot of wealth, but we have all the numbers. And if enough people, I'm convinced that if enough people are educated enough into these situations and where they come from and who's behind it all, that we can make a major difference.
How?
By being involved in our local and state government. That's the biggest, because the federal government can be controlled by the states. The federal government can be, we can get the state governments to represent us on the federal government, and these laws can be changed. These regulations can be stopped, but it has to be done through education and through involvement from the local population.
Now, one of the means that you're talking about getting control on the local level has also been utilized by the people with Agenda 21, has been by dissolving the borders between our cities and our counties and making us into regions.
Right.
And you want to explain that a little bit more?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, basically what region, you're talking about regional governance, and that's one term that they use, is governance. And what governance is, it's very different from government. We have a government as defined by our Constitution here. They're not following it, but and really, truth be told, they haven't followed it for, well, our whole lifetime. But when you get into governance, what you're talking about are rules and regulations by appointed bureaucrats, and you're talking about regional appointees. And basically what regionalism does is it creates a layer of government, or, you know, called governance, over two or more governing entities. And worldwide, the globalists have split the world into 10 federal regions years ago. And I'm trying to remember now the breakdown. I believe North America was region one. There's also the Caribbean. There was the North American region, the Caribbean, the Middle East and North Africa, Eastern Europe and Central Asia. That's another region. The Pacific, South Asia, Latin America, Sub-Saharan Africa, East Asia, and Western Europe. The world was divided into 10 regions, and Nixon, under his executive order 11647 in 1972, he signed that executive order, and he split the United States into 10 federal regions. And when he did that, he said that he was going to bring government closer to the people, like this was somehow a good thing. But each region, and I can share with you the regions and how they're divided up. There's these 10 federal regions. Basically, what you have is every single one of them has their own capital, and I'm looking for my list here. Okay, Region 1 is Connecticut, Maine, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and Vermont. The capital is Boston. Region 2 is New York, New Jersey, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. And the capital is New York City. Region 3 is Delaware, District of Columbia, Maryland, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and West Virginia. And the capital is Philadelphia. Region 4 is Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Kentucky, Mississippi, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Tennessee. The capital of Region 4 is Atlanta. Region 5 is Illinois, Indiana, Minnesota, Michigan, Ohio, and Wisconsin. The capital is Chicago. Region 6 is Arkansas, Louisiana, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Texas. The capital of that region is Dallas-Fort Worth. Region 7 is Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, and Nebraska. The capital of Region 7 is Kansas City. Region 8 is Colorado, Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, Utah, and Wyoming. And the capital is Denver. Region 9 is Arizona, California, Hawaii, and Nevada. And the capital is San Francisco. And Region 10 is Alaska, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. And the capital is Seattle. Now, each one of these regions has an appointed leader, which we know nothing about. We don't know who this person is, but this is an appointed person. What they've done is they've taken these regions and they've created a layer of government over all of these states. And the idea is that the federal government can take these funds can flow into these regions, states are forced to comply with certain mandates, and the funds come down from on high, and they are able to harmonize laws. So they've effectively merged everything in the region to the point where basically everything within that region is now controlled by the regional governing body. And this is in fact, if you can go to the FEMA website, by the way, these regions actually still exist. The Environmental Protection Agency is still divided into these 10 federal regions. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, is still divided into these 10 federal regions. And I'm sure there's other federal government agencies as well that are divided into these 10 federal regions. But the point is when, you know, take FEMA for example, whenever you have a disaster, you have the region capital at that disaster. The funds come from, the grants come from FEMA, and we have news reports on the website where, in fact, I think it's all the way at the bottom at the moment, where an actual news report where it says that the disaster-prone area would not be allowed, people will not be allowed to rebuild, and they were getting grants in these areas. So basically, everything with all of these grants, everything, land use can be controlled. When a local government accepts one penny of federal money, they are on the hook. They have to implement all these federal programs. You literally lose control at a local level when your local officials take this grant money.
If you notice a lot of the advertising and things of that sort, or even when you pay your IRS, you'll find that they move these payment areas into different regions. And often you will see these regions designated on maps. And I've been in insurance for a number of years, and I'm starting to see these regions cropping up more and more on mapping. And you know, it's been a slow incremental process that they've been doing this. And one of the last regions that you mentioned was the Oregon, Washington, Idaho area.
Right. Yeah. See, that's
Cascadia.
Yeah. They call it they have different ones in different places. You know, and there's also regional partnerships too. So they've taken this whole thing so much further than the 10 federal regions, I mean, which still exist, but now they have like the Pacific Northwest Economic Region, which has its own website. People can go to you know, say, take Pacific Northwest Economic Region, take each letter and add a .org on the end of it. Well, you could probably put it in a search engine and find it easier. I don't have the website in front of me, but the point is, they talk a lot about partnerships and a lot about compliance. But there's a number of these regions now that are springing up. Cascadia is one of them. And that is an international region, which it literally
it crosses the borders.
Canada,
yeah,
and it involves. In fact, that Pacific Northwest does as well. Then you have the La Paz Agreement, which Reagan signed back in 1983, creating the Border 2012. At the time, they called it Border Region 21, and later on they changed the name to Border 21, and then now they're calling it Border 2012. But basically, this is a U.S. border region. According to the EPA, it's a 62.5 mile on either side of the border region, which is literally blurring the lines. Once again, you have a regional body governing our border area with Mexico, and so border security is you know, basically they've gone so far, and usually you talk about incrementalism. They started this thing in 83, and now we basically have lost control of our borders. Now we have all this Mexican drug violence going on, once again Hegelian dialectic. But this is spilling over into this country. We have Border Patrol agents being prosecuted now for doing their job. They're out of prison now. But the point is that our Border Patrol agents have been persecuted. You know, and then we had things during the Bush administration building a North American community. You know, Council on Foreign Relations came out with their building a North American community thing, I think, in 2005. Where they talked about building an outer security perimeter around Canada, the Mexico, and the United States. And basically, inward borders wouldn't be patrolled. You know,
So in other words, they're blurring the borders between the countries that are north and south of us so that we don't speak out so much when they officially do that. I mean, it's been their every intention, but they're doing it in several different ways. One of them's through regions, one of them's through the North American Union. Is that what you're kind of saying here, or?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
Well, it looks like they're blurring the borders between the internationally by several different methods. One is through blurring the borders of the states, but then they're blurring the borders of the states with the boundaries of the countries.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. See, the states are some of the biggest obstacles to their plan. States have to be in compliance with what they're doing. You know, we have in our, if the listeners want to go to governamerica.com, and on the left-hand side, click on regionalism. There's a lot of very important information in that section. And one of the things they'll find is an article from the New York Times. I believe it was right around 1935, where they were talking about, do we need the states? And knowing that the New York Times is basically the mouthpiece of the globalists, you know, I mean, they talk about the states just, I mean, they're seething. I mean, the poison with which they discuss the states. It was 71, I'm sorry. It was 1971 as I just called this up. But it's just absolute poison. They talk about the states suffering from weak executives, fragmented and obsolete fiscal procedures, badly staffed and malportioned legislators, poor administrators, and political selected judiciaries and constitutions would severely restrict their ability to meet or respond to the demands made on modern government. You know, they go on and on and on, just totally trashing the states. These people hate the states, and states are corrupt. They have become corrupted. But the point is that states are so important, because when our founding fathers set this country up, they set this country up as originally 13, but it was, they were separate countries. And each one of our states are separate sovereign countries. And this, and regionalism is a way for the federal government today, those people who want compliance and want to do away with the governing power of the states, to literally usurp that authority by funding and keeping the states on the hook and forcing them to comply so that the federal funds, you know, which they need really badly, can flow into the states and use those dollars to control what the legislatures do. It's a very evil, but it has been a very effective system for them.
I need to go ahead and do a station ID, and you're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio. And we're streamed on the Internet at khen.org. And our guests this evening are Nancy Levant and Darren Weeks, and my co-host this evening is Shannon Hemingway. And Nancy, while I was at it, both of you do articles for News with Views, and Nancy, yours are really quite prolific on the subjects of dealing with various avenues on the what we had mentioned in our introduction with you human rights and Agenda 21 and that sort. Do you have a website of your own?
No, I'm really, I hate to say the word, but I'm really in partnership with Darren Weeks.
Okay, well, and that's, hey. and he's probably a good webmaster, too.
That's right.
Thank you.
Yeah, Melanie, there's something that I just have to say. I want to read something. I want people to understand that this system that we're dealing with, the globalism and the regionalism, is really quite an old plan, and I would like to just read you a couple of goals, and then I'm going to tell you who wrote these goals. These were called the intermediate goals, necessary basically for the one world government. The first one, number one goal, is to confuse, disorganize, and destroy the forces of capitalism around the world. The second goal was to bring all nations together into a single world system, which is called regionalism, lo and behold. The third goal was to force advanced countries to pour prolonged finance into underdeveloped countries. Number four, divide the world into regional groups at the transitional stage to total world government. Then they say that populations will more readily abandon their loyalty to their countries and accept loyalty to their region instead, and that later the regions can be brought together into a world order. The fifth goal is the indoctrination of youth to embrace Marxism, which will be put under other labels such as democracy, as the correct and social viewpoint, the correct and political social viewpoint. And the sixth goal was to neutralize youth against religious influences of home and all other concepts of rigid morality, which might interfere with the acceptance of Marxism or a communist doctrine. Now, I would like to tell you who wrote these goals. These goals were written in 1942 by one Joseph Stalin. And when we realize where this is all coming from, it's a very, very frightening scenario. And on that note, let me say, to me, the two most important documents that the American people need to have clearly implanted into their heads is, number one, Agenda 21. You must read Agenda 21. You don't know what's going on in your country if you don't read Agenda 21. If you read it, you do know what's going on. And number two, I ask that you read the Communist Manifesto. The Communist Manifesto is a little tiny thing. It's maybe 30 or 40 pages long. But one of the things that the Communist Manifesto will tell you is that the middle class is really very, very loathed. And one of the reasons why the it deals, of course, once again, with the ownership of property. They don't like people owning property. Only government is to own property. And, of course, that's a very, very communistic theory. It's a very socialistic slash communistic theory. It doesn't work. It's never worked in the history of mankind thus far. They do keep trying. But it's the middle class is really very loathed. It is a party of laborers. But the problem is the laborers get absolutely nothing for their labor.
You know, I have to wonder, though, when they make it sound like, okay, that nobody owns any property, but in communist Russia and some of these other communist nations, when you have the hierarchy in those governments, I would figure that the ones that are getting the brunt of the money that filters up to the top, they would own property. I can't imagine them not. If they don't own it there, they would have to own it in other areas of the world, do you think?
Well, you know, the rules I don't think ever affect the world's billionaires. You know, I think you can pick any point in human history and you can see that the wealthiest of the wealthy, the rules don't apply to them. But, you know, what's interesting about the communist connection to this is that when the Bolsheviks finally succeeded in taking over Russia, they did that by two means. They seized control of the banks and the money supply, and they seized all of the stocks of food, of the stored food in the country.
And that's all being implemented now.
And what are we seeing here? We are seeing farmers absolutely shut down. We are seeing our food supply being tampered with to the point of we have a population in ill health. No doubt, mostly because of the genetic hocus-pocus that they're playing with our food supply.
We have Terminator seeds being produced by Monsanto.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, Darren and I were talking about, Darren found another very interesting thing, and I think that this is important, because when you talk about this political system that's coming into play, one of the foundation notes of this system is population reduction, massive population reduction. I can remember years ago, maybe 5 years ago, reading how Monsanto had planted an experimental crop in Mexico, a corn crop, and that the men in these villages ended up being sterilized from this corn. And Darren just read something very, very interesting to me right before the show on that. Darren, explain. Tell them what you found out about the... no, it's really very interesting.
Yeah, I'll have to find... let's see. Give me a second here.
Okay.
But for one thing, they're coming out with a... are you talking about the killer chip implant or the male thing?
The male thing.
Okay. Give me a second here. Go ahead and...
Okay. Well, the point is, you know, we're talking about the government gaining control of all land. If they gain control of all land, they have control of all people. But there's, you know, the billionaires and the people who are running this operation, of which, what, maybe there's 10,000 of them in the world? Maybe there's 20,000? That's a...
Okay, I found it.
Okay, go ahead.
Basically, this was reported in the U.K., it's a publication called Metro, and it says Men on the Path to Extinction. And basically what they're saying here is that men are on the road to extinction as their genes shrink and slowly fade away. Medical students heard today. A researcher in human sex chromosomes say that the male Y chromosome was dying and could run out within the next 5 million years. But Professor Jennifer Graves said men may follow the path of a type of rodent which still manages to reproduce despite not having the vital genes that make up the Y chromosome. She told medical students at the annual outreach public lecture at the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland, a second species of human beings could even be born in the future. She says you need a Y chromosome to be a male. 300 million years ago, the Y chromosome had 1,400 genes on it. and now it's only got 45 left.
Wow.
So at
that
this
is
rate, we're going to run out of genes and the Y chromosome in about 5 million years, she says. The Y chromosome is dying, and the big question is, what happens then? The male Y chromosome has a gene, SRY is what it's called, which switches on the development of testes and pumps out male hormones that determine maleness. In her lecture entitled The Decline and Fall of the Y Chromosome and the Future of Men, Professor Graves discussed the disappearance of the Y chromosome and the implications for humans. But anyway, you know, we know that a lot of these people that are behind all of this, you know, Agenda 21 and UN stuff, basically, they're very, very, well, they're eugenicists. You know, they're the ones who are funding the research on genes, and we've covered a lot of this on the show as well. But the point is that with all this manipulation that's going on, you know, with our food supply and this kind of stuff, I mean, it could very well be that this isn't all being done. I mean, this is being done on purpose. I mean, I was just telling Nancy on the phone, it seems to me like every single time I turn on, and I'm not a chauvinistic person in any way, but I have noticed that every single time I turn a TV on, and I don't watch these sitcoms, but, you know, whenever I turn the TV on, they're always making fun of men. I mean, we're always being portrayed as a bunch of buffoons. And, you know, it just seems, and then you read all the UN documentation. Everything the United Nations puts out is designed to supplant the role of men in any kind of governing capacity. So I look at this and I connect the dots. I believe there is an attack on men.
Darren, there are actually commercials that run on main primetime TV right now that talk about how women can take this new drug and it will stop their menstrual cycles for all but one or two times a year.
Mm-hmm.
Why would they do that?
And then you got the Gardasil situation.
And then you got the Gardasil.
Keep in mind the Gardasil situation. You know, we were fighting that battle for a long time. One day, my wife called me, and this is back, a few years ago now. But she called me on the phone, and I was working late nights at the time, and she says, I know you're sleeping, but you're going to want to know about this. She says the legislature here in the state of Michigan is going to pass a measure. They're trying to get this passed where it's going to require sixth grade girls to be vaccinated against the human papillomavirus, which was the virus that they say causes what was it, Nancy?
Ovarian cancer.
Cervical cancer.
Cervical cancer.
Yeah,
correct.
Cervical cancer.
Yes, cervical. That's right.
You know, and immediately I was furious because I've done research on vaccines, and I can't think of a single one that's good. Maybe some people would disagree with me on that, but the kind of stuff that they put in it, we know they put mercury in a lot of this stuff. We know that there's a lot that can be said on vaccines, and I wasn't very fond of having it mandated here in the state of Michigan, especially since the fact that I have two girls myself. And so I went to the computer and I did some research, and I dug up the article that she was talking about, and I made some phone calls to some pharmaceutical companies, and I found out who was behind this whole thing. Turns out it was a woman in the legislature named Beverly Hammerstrom. She was a senator, and she was working to get this passed. I called her office and I talked to her receptionist, and this receptionist, you know, one thing that when you talk to these people, you be friendly, get them to the point where, you know, I mean, maybe joke around with them a little bit, because if they like you, they start, you know, getting chatty, and then they let things slip. Well, in this case, this woman actually told me, she says, you know, because I was talking about the safety of vaccinations in general. And she says that, she says, I assure you that the senator has done her homework. She says there's a lot of people working on this. And I says, really? And who might they be? And then she turned around and she said, well, for instance, there's a group out of Washington, D.C. called Women in Government. And so I had my notepad there, and I'm jotting down Women in Government. And I says, okay, and, you know, tell me about this group. And so she went ahead and was telling me a little bit about this. Well, I got off the phone with her. The first thing I did is go to the search engine. I pulled up the website and went through and discovered that they are partners, well, you know, it just so happens, with the big pharmaceutical companies. The very companies that are going to benefit from the legislation that this traitorous dirtbag woman of a legislator was pushing. And so I took that at the time I worked at a local news station, a CBS affiliate, and I took it to our news director and I said, look, I got a story for you. I had printed, he says, he was in the office with an intern at the time. He says, can you print all this stuff out? I said, sure, you bet I can. So I went down to the control room. I sat down at the computer, pulled up everything, printed it all out, took it back, and I said, here's the original article where it talks about what she's doing. Here's where she was the immediate past chair, Melody, of Women in Government, this woman, Beverly Hammerstrom. She turned out to be the immediate past chair. She was on the board of directors. I printed out that information. I printed out the page where it had where the group's partnering, where they partnered with this group, and I says, here it all is. And he says, wow, man, you work for 60 minutes. But I tell that story because, and then the following day, they actually went and talked to Hammerstrom, and she looked like she had got her hand caught in the cookie jar. I mean, she was shrinking behind her desk as the reporter was asking her these questions. But when they came back, I talked to the news director after that, and he says, you know, he says, it's really interesting because they act like it was no big deal. Like this kind of thing shouldn't have bothered them at all, because this kind of thing in state government is so routine. They were surprised anybody was asking any questions about it.
Well, that's true. I've found that one of the most revealing places to go to is when you start checking out the board of directors and that sort. You will find so many names on there that cross over into avenues of government. The nepotism is huge. But when you find that there's so much conflict of interest and nobody's called on it anymore, and or their funding comes from a source that you makes you have to wonder why would an oil company be funding, you know, one thing that would seem to be in antithesis to its existence. It's really quite a telling thing. And one of the things I was doing some research on the other day was, because you'd had like Vicki Davis on
right.
your program on Saturday, and her and I will often exchange some ideas back and forth, and I've come to find out that it's almost like our joint chiefs of staff now is run by a private partnership of a data collecting company, and so there you have a private company doing our military maneuvers, and these people, you start looking at the names and you start finding out their backgrounds, and it's amazing. You know, I mean, why would we have our military's plans being decided by a
corporation?
Yeah.
Wow.
But to get it back to the Agenda 21 thing, what's so really important on understanding what it is that these people have created hundreds and thousands of non-governmental organizations that have taken over the duties that can go outside of legislative hand tying. I don't know what else the term I want instead, but you know, regulations and that sort, and implement a lot of these plans, and yet they partner up with these governmental entities and implement this agenda. And this agenda isn't new. It was, you're seeing the same names involved in it now that started it back at the turn of the 1900s, you know, who control the medical professions and the schools and the government, and their whole families are participating in government all through various layers, and they're telling us, you know, this is where we're going, and our implementation of our government is taken out of our hands.
Yeah, you know, Melody, the people that tie in, and on the local level, the people that tie in through grants, they're called stakeholders. It means they've got a stake in something. Well, let me tell you what their stake is. Their stake is their next operating budget. People, you know, if you want to survive now in this world and in the world of regionalism, you have to play ball with these people. And as soon as you take government funding, as soon as you partner and get into this web, if you want to keep your money coming to run your organization, to run your nonprofit, you have to do what they tell you to do. And by they, I mean regional managers. Now, here's the problem. We don't know who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Their names are never published. The names of their groups are never published. You know, you go on the Internet and you try to find out who your regional management is. Even on the local level, in your counties, you don't know who they are. Now, here's a for instance. I found something up in the neck of the woods where I live called the Grand Vision Decision. And what it did was, this is a group that tied 6 counties together in this area up here where I live. They tied 6 counties together. They made this regional partnership. The whole thing is based on land use policies, and this regional group is getting money from up top somewhere, probably from the state government, but they have decided, this regional group has decided, that only 2 towns out of all the towns in the 6 counties are going to get quote-unquote development dollars. They also decided that the rural roads were not going to be maintained anymore, except for like the highways that go through, the state highways that go through, but the little roads in all of these 6 counties were basically going to be let go. And, you know, this is the trap. You know, this is the reason all your little tiny nonprofits that have, you know, in our heads, all of our community nonprofits are these wonderful little humanitarian groups that are doing wonderful things for the people. You know, they're providing social services, and they're providing food banks, and they're doing this and that and the other. But the problem is, they're tied into this system, and they have to perform these stakeholding duties in your community, and it all goes back to land use policies. It always does. And there's one other thing that they do. When you get tied in to the web through your grants and through your partnerships and through your stakeholder status, the other thing that happens is data collection of all the people in your communities. They're collecting information on you. They're doing profiles on you. They're trying to find out if you're going to be a good community member or whether you're going to be a community member that doesn't want to play the game.
Yep.
And I mean, it's Darren and I have talked, we talked one day on the radio show about something called fusion centers.
Yeah.
Fusion centers are kind of big regional databases that have been set up. And I think that they're getting information from everywhere, from all of the quote-unquote partners.
Keep in mind, Chapter 40 of Agenda 21, getting back to Agenda 21, Chapter 40 is information for decision-making.
Information for decision-making.
And everything in that chapter is talking about databases. And with the fusion centers, we know that these are little branches of the Office of Homeland Security.
Yes.
You know, these things recently came to the forefront, by the way, and I don't know if you've talked about it on your show, Melody, but there was a Missouri fusion center called MIAC Missouri Information Analysis Center, I guess is what it was called, MIAC.
Yep.
And they were they put out a report basically branding constitutional loving Americans as potential terrorists. You know, and well, you know, then you start asking yourself the question, where does all this come from? Well, the Department of Homeland Security issues government grants, and they issue it to local police departments and areas where there and all this stuff sprung up once again out of September 11th, 2001. And but the idea, which is where Department of Homeland Security came from, you know, which was planned in advance also because of the roadmap to national security laid out the framework for that, and they implemented it after 9/11. But the point is that these Department of Homeland Security government grants go into these local police departments. They implement programs called community-oriented policing services, or COPS, which comes out of the Department of Justice. But the point is that this is what these areas, these things do, is they collect information
about you,
about people,
yep,
everybody, and they profile and they do things to access your home, you know. And I think about Nikki Rapana, and how she's talked a lot, and I know she's been a guest on your show. They had a pilot program in Seattle where she was at the time, and it was called Weed and Seed. And the idea is to profile the people, find out who the rabble are, who the troublemakers might be, and to try to get those people out of the neighborhood and seed the neighborhood with people that they think are going to be good model citizens. You know, I mean, so this is kind of thing. But as far as the regionalism thing, I got a quote here from Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was the former national security advisor. And he said about regionalism, he says, "We cannot leap into world government in one quick step. The precondition for eventual world government is progressive regionalization, because thereby we move toward larger, more stable, cooperative units."
There's your communism again.
Well, yep, there's your compliance.
Both Zbigniew Brzezinski and Henry Kissinger have been there hanging around the D.C. area quite a lot. It didn't matter whether it was a Democratic or a Republican occupancy. And one of the things about that regionalism, there's a part, Section 10 of the Constitution under Article, I think it's Article 1, And it says, "No state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation, grant letters of mark or reprisal, coin money, emit bills of credit, make anything but gold and silver, coin a tender in payment of debts, pass any bill of attainder, ex post facto law, or law impairing the obligation of contracts, or grant any title of nobility." So right there, it is apparently stating that, you know, that they shouldn't really be making these alliances. And then I noticed, I mean, there's more than one way that they're setting these regions up, because the Navy right now is trying to utilize the Northwest for making that, and I don't have the legislation the environmental impact statement and that sort, where they're utilizing that territory as a training area. Are you familiar with that? Nope.
I'm sorry. I was.
Okay.
Can you say that again?
The Navy is in the Northwest is utilizing Washington and Oregon and Idaho as they have a environmental impact statement that's involved with utilizing this area as a training area, and it's going to be involving certain species. In other words, this is kind of conglomerating this area in a region in another manner, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah. Well, you know, they're doing a lot of these types of things. The reason I was a little bit distracted here, I was looking at Article 4, Section 3, Clause 1, of the Constitution, which says that new states may be admitted by the Congress into this union, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state nor any state be formed by the junction of two or more states or parts of states without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned as well as the Congress. So, I mean, right there you have a blatant violation of the Constitution. But with regard to the regionalism thing, I found also the website where your listeners can go. It's PNWER.org. That is the Pacific Northwest Economic Region. There are several states. I believe Idaho is among them. I know Idaho was included in the Cascadia thing. But anyway, there are several states involved in this regional system. And the Pacific Northwest region, is, as we mentioned earlier, is an international thing. It goes into Canada. It goes into the United States. And by doing this, what they've done is form a layer of governance over international borders.
Yes.
And I know with Cascadia, they were talking about making it the two-nation vacation. And you can Google that, and I'm sure it'll bring it up. But the point is that when you've done this, you've blurred the border internationally. I know that here in Michigan, we have the Council of Great Lakes Governors, which is another international partnership.
Yes.
among several, all of the Great Lakes states.
Yes, a region, yes.
And so, I mean, you have all of these little partnerships and all these regions forming forming at the northern part of our border, and then you have the La Paz Agreement creating the border region at the southern part. You know, so it all makes perfect sense when you start to examine these things. And I mean, it's going on all over the country right now. You can go to charlotteusa.org, and there's a Charlotte Regional Partnership between North Carolina and South Carolina. There's the Roanoke region of Virginia. You can go to roanoke.org and find that one. There is the Research Triangle region. It's a 13 county region in North Carolina. So, I mean, the counties are being regionally merged, and they have a list of the counties there at that website. There's the Northeast Indiana Regional Partnership. So, I mean, you know, if your listeners want to put regional partnership into a search engine with quotation marks around it, it'll bring up all kinds of things. But that just gives you an idea of how far they've taken this, and the idea is to merge, to do away with all these borders between counties, between cities, between states, and ultimately between nations, to form this one-world government. And, you know, I believe it was Mikhail Gorbachev, if memory serves me correctly, who referred to the European Union as the new European Soviet.
Yes.
He referred to that region as a Soviet. And
Soviet Union.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. This is what we're talking about here. We're talking about bringing councils together and these kind of things. And what they've done is they've effectively built the Western Hemisphere version of what they've done, you know, what they built years ago in the Soviet Union. I mean, what we're looking at here is global communism. And that's what people just don't understand. They don't realize the Soviet system is being built here in America and around the world.
Yes. Can we say the word treason, please? Another thing, Melody, that I'd like to direct your listeners to, there is a website, www.america2050.org. I'm on this site now. This is a really, really important site. You're going to see this deals primarily with this the new transportation system going into the United States, which this site will very specifically tell you is to limit automobile use by 50% by the year 2050. And it also talks about what they call mega regions. And the mega regions section, they are listed. I will let your listeners just go and research this. You can see what these mega regions are. Cascadia is one of them, the Great Lakes region, Northern California, Southern California, so on and so forth. But there is a thing to click that says infrastructure. And if you scroll about halfway down, you're going to find a map of what the new, okay, when Obama came in, he announced plans for this investment in high-speed rail. And he's got $8 billion down payment that was made in the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. And then he's got an additional $5 billion in his proposed budget for what he calls the Trans-American Passenger Network. Now, what's interesting about this map is it's color-coded, and it actually shows you, number one, the different regions they've got. Now, what this high-speed rail system, now, they've got a map for this thing already, so, you know, they know what they're doing. But if you scroll down just a little bit under that map, there's a little blurb that is entitled Beyond Driving and Flying. And so as you can clearly see, our ability to drive cars while our automobile industry is crashing and burning before our eyes is clearly another part of this plan. They don't want us to be mobile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did bring up that site that showed the EIS in the Northwest Training Range Complex, but I'm going to have to look into this in a little bit more because this is something that I found that the Navy's taking on this green sustainability thing, and I've noticed that the Army and some of the other military branches are doing that, which it's kind of interesting.
Well, you know,
Melody, let's talk about water.
Okay. Oh, yes.
You will notice that our entire southern border, from all the way to San Diego, all the way over to Florida, for years now, has been under an annual state of emergency, either through weather or through border crisis with Mexico. The entire southern region of the United States for years has been under an annual, yearly state, declared state of emergency. We have also had some declared states of emergency up the East Coast due to weather. Now we got the Navy talking about taking over a huge section of the West Coast for military training. You know, all the watershed systems in the United States, all of them have been taken over. They're designated watershed systems. They belong to the government. Look at what is happening.
Well, keep in mind, too, that water districts, you know, with water, you know, it's another method through regionalism at connecting and various, you know, putting layers of government over certain other layers of government, you know, controlling, you know, merging systems of government, because water districts are crossed, you know, they can be cross-city, they can be cross-county. So you have water districting going on as well. And as far as water shortages and that kind of thing, you know, I can't talk about that without talking about weather modification. Because modification doesn't get any play very much at all. And yet, we hear all this stuff about climate change. We hear all this stuff about so-called global warming and how we're blamed for all of this stuff that's going on. You know, and former Defense Secretary William Cohen, on April 28, 1997, he said in a conference, it was actually a news briefing, others are engaging even in an eco-type of terrorism whereby they can alter the climate, set off earthquakes, volcanoes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves. So there are plenty of ingenious minds out there that are at work finding ways in which they can wreak terror upon other nations. It's real, and that's the reason why we have to intensify our efforts. And that's why this is so important. We know cloud seeding has been going on for a half a century, at least, I took it back to the 1940s where they were researching about it. We know that the Air Force has put out a report called Owning the Weather in 2025, but yet we know that the actually the People's Republic of China has been modifying its weather for many, many years.
Darren, you interviewed a PhD who did a research project in the Soviet Union about dragging hurricanes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was Professor James McCanney. Had him on the show a few times. And, yes, he said that he worked with Russian scientists to develop a system of buoys because we're told that hurricanes are actually storms that are caused by warm sea temperatures. And he says, no, they're electrical storms, and they can be grounded out. And he actually worked with Russian scientists to actually develop a system of buoys to ground out these things before they can before they hit land. And he said that they took their research and gave it to the government, and the government perverted it. And what they intended, what he says is that the government has an ability now to use high-powered satellites and ionize a path through the hurricane. Using some kind of laser system, I guess, through the eye of the hurricane, and basically they can steer them wherever they want to take them. And I've watched some of these hurricanes and some of the insane paths that they take, and it's pretty interesting. In fact, I remember one particular news report out of Charlotte, North Carolina, where they were talking about how it was almost like the storm had a mind of its own. And we've seen with the Hurricane Katrina situation and some of the stuff that happened there, it looked very much like a FEMA operation, like a rehearsal for mm-hmm. martial law, you know. But there's so much on weather modification that can be researched and can be documented, but the point of the matter is you can't have an honest discussion about climate change, really, in my thinking, without talking about weather modification. And it gets back to the control of water, because if you can control, you can steer jet streams, if you can create high-pressure systems and low-pressure systems, if you can, we have the HAARP facility in Alaska, which sends electromagnetic waves into the atmosphere. Apparently they are able to find underground tunnels with this thing, according to what's said by Nick Begich and others. But the point is that, if they can do that, could they not concentrate some of this energy on fault lines and set off earthquakes, like William Cohen, the former Defense Department Defense Secretary, said? I mean, is William Cohen a conspiracy theorist?
Exactly. We have
all these things going on. Nothing's ever talked about in this country. China, during the Olympics, it was openly reported in the media that they modified their weather so that they wouldn't have rain during the Olympics. And yet we hear dead silence from our government about it being going on. If we have droughts out west, why doesn't the government make it rain? You know, if we have water shortages, why don't they seed clouds? Why aren't we busy desalinizing the oceans? I mean, we can build a pipeline for oil hundreds of miles through unbelievable terrain, as they did with the Trans-Alaska oil pipeline during the early 1970s. They can build it under the ocean and through unbelievable terrains, unforgiving cold. They can build pipelines and stuff, permafrost.
I believe that's going to be the future of the water, actually.
They need to be doing something, and yet we never have anything about it. The only thing I can say is the crisis there is for a reason. It's for a purpose.
Right.
And we don't know, but they're already creating these droughts with weather modification activities.
Well, I had Rosalind Peterson on a few weeks ago, and she sent me chart after chart after chart came off of NOAA's website, the National Oceanic
I don't know what the other two letters stand for, but anyways.
Atmospheric Agency.
Atmospheric Agency, right. And
Administration, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. And anyways, it was pretty clear that they are, there's just program after program after program that is affecting climate. But at the same time, when you're affecting climate in one area, it does the opposite in another area near it. So I can see why they're not real open to discussing it. But by looking at these charts, you could definitely see that, you know, we have an effect on what's going on with the weather. And it isn't just by pollution and by accident. These are programs that are definitely there helping, who are probably going to the highest bidder. And so those that aren't, you know, paying to have these programs are probably, you know, getting the brunt of, you know, what it, the negative effects of it.
You know, it's also interesting to me that year after year after year, California burns.
Right.
Year after year after year. And you know where California burns? Burns along the fault line. I find that very interesting as well.
Well, there's a lot of people out there that are speculating on some of this, and that's one of the interesting parts about being networked on the internet is to kind of bring attention to some of these things that are curious or you start wondering about, because there is a lot of things that are taking place that are questionable and should be brought to attention. And our news media is certainly not doing it. We're getting a lot of, you know, pablum.
Yeah.
But they certainly want to shut us down. They don't like the fact that we talk.
Well, and, you know, at this point in time, I'd like to say that there's a lot of positive things to, you know, it would be nice to be working towards, but unless you understand the all-encompassingness of this Agenda 21 and how they want to micromanage our lives and yet do this on a global scale, then how are we going to have an idea of how to stop it or right it if we don't at least look at the information that's out there? And Agenda 21, the document itself is like 1,100 pages long, and I've only been able to get a hold of a couple of copies of the abridged versions.
Well, we have the full document. If they go to governamerica.com, there's an Agenda 21 section right on the main page, and we have the whole document that we link to right on the UN website. So if anybody wants to read it, and I highly recommend it. There's a little bit of, you have to learn the lingo a little bit. You might have to understand exactly the way they talk, because they're United Nations is very good. They're very excellent wordsmiths. They're very good at using the language. I think you alluded to that a little bit earlier, Melody, about the lingual stuff. They're very, very good at making things sound pretty. With regard to putting property off limits, they talk about having access to land, you know, and the importance of people having access to land. And I always zero in on that, because the average person reading that would say, well, see there, they don't want to take away our property. Well, when you have access, you can go to any public place and put your feet on the ground, and that's access to land. You're accessing it. But that doesn't talk about property ownership. It doesn't talk about your ability to own and control what you do when you're accessing the land. You know, as far as weather modification is concerned, there's a report that was put out by University of North Carolina. It was Research Associate, Department of City and Regional Planning, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, in partnership with the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The reports, if the listeners want to go to governamerica.com, on the left-hand side in the main section where we have the navigational stuff, there's a section called weather modification. There's a lot of stuff in there in that section, very important information, I think. But one of those things is a PDF file which we saved from this Department of City Regional Planning in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and the Department of City and Regional Planning, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The name of the report is Sustainable Development and Natural Hazards Mitigation. They come right out and basically tell how useful these natural disasters are. In an area, page 19, under the heading of Windows of Opportunity, they say, despite the wide array of tools and techniques that are available to governments to operationalize the principles of sustainability and mitigation, one of the roadblocks to implementation is the fact that much of the land within local jurisdictions has already been developed according to practices and traditions that are far from sustainable. Ironically, the time immediately following a natural disaster provides a community with a unique window of opportunity for inserting an ethic of sustainability in guiding development and redevelopment in high-risk areas. With forethought and planning, communities that are rebuilt in the aftermath of a natural hazard can be built back so that they are more resilient to future hazards, breaking the pattern of repeated hazard destruction rebuilding. At the same time, the community is given the opportunity to incorporate other attributes of sustainability into its second chance development, such as energy efficiency, affordable housing, use of recycled building materials, reduction of water use, and environmental protection. So there you have, they've come right out and said, these natural disasters are very useful when they want to relocate people off the land, relocate them to human settlement areas, and to wipe out the unsustainable housing. You know, there's nothing quite like a natural disaster to pull that off now, is there?
And what is unsustainable housing? It's your private homes on your private land.
That's why I think weather modification is so vitally important. You know,
and I'm glad you're having people like Roger Peterson on
to talk about it.
Yeah, and I'm glad you tied that in there to make that, you know, understanding why that's so important. But when you were talking also about the water, there's a Senate Bill 787 that's supposedly in committee right now that's taking the term navigable waters out of the Clean Water Act, which would affect all waters in this country, which in a sense could be federalizing our water.
Mm-hmm. Which is an implementation of Agenda 21. Really what it is, it's not really federalizing our water. According to legislation it is, but really it's internationalizing them.
Right, right.
Because there are at least two chapters, one, I believe it's chapters 17 and 18 of Agenda 21. One of them deals with freshwater resources, and the other one deals with the seas and the semi-enclosed seas and what have you, lakes and what have you. Basically, there's not a drop of this water on Earth that these people don't think they own. There's not a single molecule on this Earth that these people don't think they're own. We're in a day and age, Melody, where they're literally charging people now for the air that we breathe. The Supreme Court came out a few years ago and said that carbon dioxide was a pollutant, and by that ruling, that was the federal government declaring every single person on the face of the earth, just by the fact that you live, by the fact that you draw breath into your lungs, you are a polluter. These people think they own the elements, they think they own the earth, and they think they own it all. And you are just, you're an intruder on their property.
That's what they think, right there.
That's exactly right. It's all theirs. And what do you do when you have too much of a certain animal? You know, whenever the federal government has too many wolves in a certain area, well, you know, they let them build up a lot because it's useful to persecute the ranchers. But whenever they have a nuisance species, what's the first thing they do? They come in and start culling the numbers, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when we're intruders on their property, they view us as cattle. We're nothing like, but just animals on their plantation. And so our numbers have become to the point where they think we need to be called.
Well, one of the,
and relocated.
One of the things that really backs this up is to go in and start reading some of the publications that these people that have created this document
think and believe, and then it makes it much more concrete and clear as to how the population, which ties into eugenics and land control, and because essentially Agenda 21, what they're going to do, it isn't just a matter of getting the land out of private property, but they're going to turn around and sell the concessions to the resources and the land to these corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And they've already done that in numerous places, like with the Trans-Texas Corridor.
Yep. Well, you know, one of the things that you were talking about, the quotes of some of the people that are behind this, we have a quote on the website from Daniel Sitars, who is the attorney and environmental activist who actually wrote the authoritative version of Agenda 21. And what he said is, effective execution of Agenda 21 will require a profound reorientation of all human society, unlike anything the world has ever experienced. A major shift in the priorities of both governments and individuals, and an unprecedented redeployment of human and financial resources. He says this shift will demand that a concern for the environmental consequences of every human action, you were talking about the military a moment ago, be integrated into individual and collective decision-making at every level. There are specific actions which are intended to be undertaken by multinational corporations and entrepreneurs, by financial institutions and individual investors, by high-tech companies and indigenous people, by workers, labor unions, by farmers and consumers, by students, schools, by governments and legislators, by scientists, by women, by children, in short, by every person on earth. In other words, what we're looking at, and I always, whenever I share that quote, I ask the question, does this not sound a little bit revolutionary to you? Because what we're talking about here, just like he said, a profound reorientation. I mean, literally everything is going to be measured on the stick, on the ruler of sustainability. And what we've done, what they've done is they have drawn in some of the most radical, insane, extremist environmentalists, and they have put them in control of all policy that's being formed in this country on a federal level, but also now through these grants and through these regional bodies in a state and local level as well. This is how it's getting done. It is the international program being implemented right in your backyard.
And, you know, Melody, another thing that I like people to consider is when you look at Mexico, Central and South America, when you're looking at Mexico, you're looking at a mess, because that country's always just politically just been a catastrophe. You're looking at Central and South America, you're looking at socialist countries. They're to our south. To our north in Canada, you're looking at pretty much a socialist country. You travel across the Atlantic to Europe, you're looking at a socialist country or communist countries. You go into
communism is socialism.
The Mideast, and you're looking at, I don't know what you, call that over there. And then you go over to Asia, and you're looking primarily at communist countries. We are literally surrounded. Literally surrounded. Now, Darren found an interesting quote by a Soviet professor who said that he expected by the year 2010 that America would be divided up and basically pieces given to other areas of the world. And when you look at what is happening and how we are surrounded all over the world, and you consider that China is now the kind of the economic, well, it is the economic driving force to the United States, because China owns the United States now.
And our leaders made that possible, by the way.
And that, yes, our leaders did that. Our leaders did all of this to us.
Mm-hmm.
They crashed everything. They're attacking our religion. They've attacked our school systems. They've attacked our health. They've attacked our farms and our food chain. I mean, they did it all. Not one American person said, "Will you please do this?"
And one of them, you know, and again, I've brought this up before, but I still think it's so very important. When you have Henry Paulson
being head of, you know, head of Goldman Sachs, and then being the head of the Treasury, and then also being on the Board of Governors with the Nature Conservancy, which
yep.
is a landholder. That is an ominous sign for.
And he was appointed to that position by George W. Bush, a Republican, which shows once again there's no difference between these parties.
No, none.
People need to get out of this dialectic, this left versus right dialectical nonsense, and start to realize that we've been sold out by both parties.
Well, that's why they play us off each other and split and divide us. But it's getting to the point where I think want to say thank you guys for coming on and giving us your thoughts and opinions about what is going on with this Agenda 21 and other, you know, world events or nation events. And do you guys have any closing comments before we end this program tonight?
Well, the only thing that I would say is you know, we can lay out problems, and we tried to educate the listeners, but the biggest thing that I can think of is to get involved in your local community, start attending your local city council meetings, find out what's going on there. I know in my local area they had been working to adopt a master plan, which is a master plan of land use. They are literally mapping out in every area how the land's going to be used. And in my particular case, they said that, you know, my property, well, is supposed to be open space. So, I mean, you know, everyone needs to understand these maps are being laid out. But if you don't attend your city council meetings and understand how it's going to happen, you know, then you have to educate people in your community and get involved and put pressure on these little rascals. You know, this is the solution. This is the only solution that's going to work. You know, a lot of other people come up with other things. But I hammer this because I think this is the one area where we actually have some muscle. Being involved in educating in our local communities, because these are where the plans are being implemented.
Ditto, I absolutely agree. And the only other thing I would add would be very, very vocal. Be vocal publicly. Because, ladies and gentlemen, you have absolutely nothing whatsoever to lose.
Well, when the GPS coordinates are being mapped on your front door,
exactly.
The Census Bureau is now mapping every GPS front door in America. Well, why do you think they'd want to do that unless they're trying to let you find out where the people are living when the time comes to declare martial law and to go get the people? You know, that's
yes, and
point.
If you haven't read your martial law, the executive orders for martial law, please do so tonight.
And as it goes to show that it, you know, don't take our word for it, because you know that's one of the nice things about your site is you do provide a lot of links to the documentation to prove and prove to the people that, you know, we're not making this stuff up. It's out there. It's out there in plain view for us to find out. And if we're going to do anything about it, we need to start doing it rather quickly, because they're kind of closing in on the end
That's
of
right.
their agenda here.
That's right.
And, that is right.
And thank you so much for having us, Melody.
Yeah, and I want to thank you to both, and I enjoyed it, and I hope we'll have you back again sometime here.
We'd love to. Thank you so much.
All right.
All right.
Thank you very
God
much.
Bless, and have a good evening.
Okay, you too. Good night.